I'd like to welcome everyone to our continuation of our series of talks by Jim Loudon. I don't know if it's the speaker or the topic, but we had to cancel this talk the last time because of a winter storm. Now we've only got a winter storm watch, I guess.
It's begun snowing.
Yes, I slid over a couple of times. But anyhow, let me introduce Jim Loudon, commentator on space and astronomy for National Public Radio from the Exhibit Museum at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, speaking to us today on Venus.
First, some announcements very quickly. For those of you who attended the talk that Tom Heppenheimer and I gave last May, I think it was, on the space shuttle, recommended a couple of books, one of which was his own, which I still highly recommend, and another of which was the book by Gerard O'Neill called The High Frontier. Well, the O'Neill book is now out in paperback, i.e. cheap, and furthermore has not only been put out in paperback, but has been thoroughly revised since the hardcover version, so that it is now the most up-to-date of any of the space colonization books, a little bit more so than Tom's, although Tom's is by no means obsolete, and it is now very thoroughly illustrated by my favorite space artist, Don Davis. So for all those reasons, I recommend it. I do not know whether it has hit the bookstores in East Lansing. Has anybody? It has? Good. So they got, oh, Heppenheimer's out in paper too? All right. Well, this was something I didn't know myself. Okay, so two very excellent books. Either of them I recommend. Tom Heppenheimer's book is Colonies in Space, and the O'Neill book is The High Frontier. And both of them apparently out in paperback and in the East Lansing bookstores. The book distribution is just so strange that, you know, I was sorry to say that I've seen the O'Neill book in paperback in the Ann Arbor bookstores, and that doesn't prove a thing about whether they're here. You know, you may get them a month earlier or a month later. And evidently in the case of Tom's book, you got it earlier. Okay, that's announcement number one. Announcement number two is that, as you know, WKAR is taping the series of lectures, at least has been doing them so far. They may or may not continue taping them. An alternative possibility is that instead of broadcasting the lectures, which tend to be fairly long for a broadcast, of course they tend to be fairly long for a lecture too, but you seem to be willing to put up with that, the radio audience may or may not be, and they try to cut them, and of course cutting any of my golden words hurts the editors so much that what they may do is a series of separate but equal sessions in the studio instead, you know, the gist of the material in the lecture. So there may be a series of astronomy broadcasts for that which are separate from these. In any case, they have been taping the lectures, and the next of those broadcasts will be the relativity talk, which I gave on October 13th. That was the one called Why You Can't Go Faster Than Light. And that will be a somewhat abridged version, about half of the full three-hour lecture. The broadcast will be on Wednesday, January 18th, in other words, this coming Wednesday, in KAR's standard lecture slot in the morning, and that is 10 a.m., and that will be on WKAR-FM, which is 90.5 megahertz. Have I got it right this time? Good. Last time I tried to make it 90.9 because the station where I got my start in Philadelphia happened to be that frequency, so I always get confused about that. 90.5 WKAR-FM, and that is Wednesday, January 18th at 10 a.m. Also, for those of you who are mobile enough and interested enough in astronomy and space not to feel restricted to East Lansing, even in this horrible weather that we have here on this strange planet, there are quite a number of things that I do all over the map, in Ann Arbor, in Bloomfield Hills, in Detroit, as well as here at East Lansing. And there is a schedule, mimeograph schedule, which gives all of those, plus information. This was prepared at the University of Michigan, so it also has information about other University of Michigan astronomy events, which I do not do, the planetarium there and various programs about telescopes open that the astronomy department there has. These are free, and they are available up here in the front. The reason we didn't put them out in the back, I don't know if everybody noticed, on the back there are posters for this series only, and please grab those if you don't have one. But if some of you are interested in places in other cities as well, that information is up here in the front. And the reason we didn't put it out in the back was we figured probably the majority of you are interested only in the East Lansing ones, that is easier to read from the ones in the back. There's so much going on that this thing is rather condensed. All the information is there. It's just a little painful to read. But anybody who's interested, or if you have friends in other cities, anywhere else in southeastern Michigan, who you think might be interested in some of the things that I do, please feel free to come up and take one at the intermission or after the program. And those are up here. The next event will be tomorrow night, in fact, in Ann Arbor, something I do called the Astronomical Film Festival, which is both lectures and films. Tomorrow night's program is essentially all films, and we'll have some films about the moon, including Apollo 17, and including a summary film about what was discovered on the moon during Apollo. And in addition, we'll have something I think would be of very great interest to a lot of people, and that is a film on the impact which happened in Siberia in 1908, 70 years ago, this coming June 30th. And there have been some nut books out about that recently, about how it was the explosion of a nuclear-powered spacecraft and all this kind of garbage. If you'd like to see what really happened in a very, very, presented in a very, very interesting way with incredible footage of some of the expeditions which the Soviets sent out there over a period of decades to study the effects of the explosion and see what had happened. It is a Soviet film. It was very, very difficult to get. It has English narration, but it's a Soviet film. It's called The Search for the Tunguska Meteorite. All of that is tomorrow night at the University of Michigan campus in Ann Arbor, and the information about it is on this sheet as well. So, okay, so much for announcements. Yeah?
One last announcement. Because of the cancellation of this talk in December, we pushed it into this spot, which had been Jupiter. We're still going to get Jupiter in, and it will be 2 weeks from tonight rather than just next month. It is on that revised schedule in the back, but that's a change rather than just one a month or two this month.
That's true. If anybody was here expecting Jupiter, you're about to get Venus. Hope the substitution of planets is not going to bother you any, but if you are here for Jupiter, we figured the best way to do this, since we did have to squeeze it together, was to put Jupiter later so at least nobody would miss, you know, anything. So if you come for Jupiter, that is 2 weeks from now. And then the following lecture, follow-up lecture to that, Beyond Jupiter, really these are two interconnected lectures, although they are independently understandable, and the follow-up lecture from that will be 2 weeks from that, you see. So you'd have only 2 weeks to forget what I said in the first one instead of four, and seemed a reasonable way to do it, but we did it that way anyway. Well, I was going to start off at the suggestion of a lady in the audience by saying we regret to announce that the planet Jupiter has been canceled due to lack of interest, but it hasn't been canceled, just postponed for 2 weeks. Okay, I think that takes care of everything. Tonight's lecture is about Venus, and if we could have the first slide, please, and have the room lights out, since the slides are prettier to look at than I am. If you ever want to win a bet or two at a cocktail party, I think you could do it by asking any of the following four questions. Number one, what is the planet that comes closest to the Earth? Number two, what is the planet that has been the target of the greatest number of spacecraft, other than the Earth and Moon, of course? Number three, what was the first planet that anybody ever landed a spacecraft successfully on? Or number four, what was the first planet that anybody ever sent back pictures from the surface to the Earth? And I'm sure at least 90% of the population would unhesitatingly answer Mars to all four of those questions. The answer, however, in all four cases is not Mars. Believe it or not, it is Venus. Venus seems to be the poor stepsister of Mars as far as knowledge of space events is concerned, but it actually has had considerably more space activity devoted to it than Mars has, mainly because of the Russians, who have launched at least 18 separate spacecraft towards Venus. Now, that counts failures as well as successes, and they had quite a number of failures in the early days, but it's characteristic of the Soviet space program that failures don't seem to bother them. They keep it up and keep it up and keep it up with incredible persistence until they finally get somewhere. They have had at least six Venus missions, which you can consider partially or wholly successful, and four of those were successful landings on the surface of the planet. Man's first landing on the surface of another planet was the Soviet spacecraft Venera 7, which touched down on the surface of Venus in December of 1970. And if you didn't know about that at the time or afterwards, it's not terribly surprising. It was not, after all, a terribly important event from the point of view of the news media. It was only man's first landing on the surface of another planet, so it made page 57 of the New York Times, and in many other media, I'm sure, was not mentioned at all. That was the first of four landers, and I will tell you in some detail what the Russians have learned about Venus, including showing you the pictures which have been sent back from Venus by the two most recent landers, Venera 9 and Venera 10. Venera, you see, is the Russian word for Venus. Those were almost a year before what everybody in America at least seems to think were the first pictures from the surface of another planet, which were, of course, the ones from the two Viking landers which touched down on Mars. These were in October of 1975. As for coming closer than Mars, yes, it does. Venus can come as close as 25 million miles to the Earth, or about 100 times as far as the Moon, which is the very nearest body to us. Mars never comes closer than 35 million miles, so that's another 10 million miles farther than Venus, and that's the extreme. Some of you may be aware that Mars currently is making a close approach to the Earth, and it is about 60 million miles away at the moment. Some of its close approaches are closer than others. In fact, right now, Mars is just about opposite to the Sun in our sky, as it must be when it is closest to the Earth. And by an incredible coincidence, the day that Mars is farthest, is closest to being opposite to the Sun in our sky, close to being 180 degrees around from the Sun, is the very day this particular year that Venus is at its farthest from us as it passes directly behind the Sun. And so that is this coming Sunday, and on Sunday you will have the rather remarkable circumstance that the four bodies, first Venus, then the Sun, then the Earth, and then Mars, will be in an almost geometrically perfect straight line. This has absolutely no significance whatever, scientific or otherwise, but it's just kind of a neat thing to know. You know, you wake up on Sunday and you say, gee, today's the day we're all lined up. And so that indicates that Venus is as far from us as it can ever get, and that is 135 million miles. Even near its farthest, of course, when it's directly behind the Sun, you can't see it, but even near its farthest, Venus is so bright that it is brighter than anything else in our sky except for the Sun and the Moon. In fact, Venus is such a brilliant object as seen from the Earth that it is visible in broad daylight if you know exactly where to look. Venus's brightness, which at night is so great that under the right circumstances it'll cast shadows on the ground all by itself, which you can see if you get out in the country away from the city lights, and if you get out there on a night when Venus is visible after twilight has ended. This is the reason that Venus is named Venus, simply because it was so bright and brilliant and beautiful. Venus was the goddess of love, of course, as everybody knows, but she was also the goddess of beauty. And it's kind of ironic that Venus is named that way, for reasons that I will show you a little bit later on. The excuse me. The interest of Venus is partly that it is the nearest planet to the Earth, but also partly that it is the planet that is most nearly like the Earth in the solar system. Venus is the only other planet which is almost exactly the same size and weight as the Earth. Therefore, you might expect it to be a twin of the Earth. It turns out that it very definitely is not. And therefore, study of why, of what Venus is, first of all, and then second phase, why Venus is the way it is sure to teach us things about why our own planet is the way it is that we would not have understood if we had stayed here at home and devoted all of our attention to the Earth. If you were on the surface of Venus, the first thing that you'd notice, I'm sure, would be the very, very un-Earth-like temperature. It is 900 degrees Fahrenheit. That is hot enough to melt lead, hot enough to melt solder, hot enough to melt tin. Venus, as a matter of fact, is the hottest planet in the solar system. Not Mercury, Venus. Venus is farther from the Sun than Mercury, but it also has an atmosphere. And it turns out that makes a difference. There's something called the greenhouse effect, which simply means that a planet with an atmosphere has a warmer surface temperature than it would if it were at the same distance from the Sun and everything else was the same, but it had no air. And an obvious example of that is the Earth and the Moon, both of which are at essentially the same distance from the Sun all the time. Okay, the Moon goes around the Earth, but it's so close to the Earth that compared to the distance of the Sun, it just doesn't matter. Moon is always essentially the same distance from the Sun as we are. The temperature on the Moon, however, averages almost 100 degrees Fahrenheit colder than the average temperature on the Earth. And the reason for that is that the Moon has no air. The Earth has a little bit of air, not very much compared to Venus, but a little bit of air, more than the Moon has, which is none, and that is enough, that little bit of air is enough to give us a surface temperature almost 100 degrees warmer than the average temperature on the Moon. You may not have thought in terms of the average temperature on the Moon, because what really impresses people about the Moon is the extremes. It gets down to 250 below zero at night there, and in the daytime at the equator, the temperature is well above the boiling point of water, say 230, 240 degrees Fahrenheit above zero. But the average temperature on the Moon, in between those extremes, is colder than the average temperature on Earth. Well, Venus is exactly the opposite extreme. Venus is closer to the Sun than we are, enough closer that it gets about twice as much sunlight. And 80% of that sunlight is reflected back into space by the clouds that totally cover the planet. But the remaining 20%, which makes it down to the surface, is trapped so tenaciously by Venus's atmosphere that Venus has a surface temperature of 900 degrees Fahrenheit day and night, summer and winter, and almost certainly equator and poles as well. It's always twice as hot as inside a hot oven baking a cake at the surface of Venus. And Venus, not Mercury, is the hottest planet in the solar system, simply because Mercury, although it is closer to the Sun, has no atmosphere to hold in the heat. Venus's air would be the next thing that you would notice if you could somehow stand the temperature, if you were standing on the surface of Venus. The temperature is caused by that atmosphere, and the reason that it is so hot is, number one, the atmosphere is almost 100 times as dense as that of the Earth, which means it's almost a liquid. Water is only 8 times denser than that. And in fact, there are actually liquids that we know that are less thick than the atmosphere at the surface of Venus. Liquid hydrogen is an example. The pressure due to that atmosphere, that enormous crushing blanket of air, is so great that it is almost 1 ton per square inch, which is equal to the pressure half a mile below the surface of the oceans on Earth. So if you want to understand what it would be like to be on the surface of Venus and to feel that air, aside from the temperature, it is more, it's a closer analogy to think in terms of being underwater on Earth than it is to think in terms of being out of the water walking around in the air. We'll come back to that when we talk in terms of, for example, erosion on Venus. You'd actually expect very little erosion, no matter how much wind there was, simply because erosion is caused by particles carried in the wind, of course. It's not caused literally by the wind itself. And those particles just aren't going to hit very hard because the air is so dense, it's so thick. So the air would definitely be the second thing you would notice. It is made almost entirely of carbon dioxide, so much so that we don't really know what else in addition it is made of. Probably it's a more or less Earth-like atmosphere, minus the oxygen, of course, which is caused by green plants. If there's one thing I guarantee there is not in a 900 degree Fahrenheit surface temperature, it is any sort of life, at least of the sort that we know on Earth. The rest of the atmosphere, what little there is probably more or less Earth-like. In other words, the nitrogen and the argon and so forth that we have. But then in addition, there's an enormous quantity of carbon dioxide. And so even if it weren't so thick, and even if the temperature were not so great, you couldn't breathe it. Carbon dioxide is not only something that you can't breathe, it's something you have to get rid of. It's what you breathe out. On top of that, Venus is totally covered by clouds. In this picture that you're seeing there behind me, this is a photograph of Venus, actually a television image, which was made in 1973 by the spacecraft Mariner 10, the only one so far that has actually taken pictures of Venus from the outside, aside from a couple of very poor ones that were taken by the Russian Venus orbiters the last time around. This picture is very, very highly exaggerated in contrast, and it's also ultraviolet, and so this is not what you would see with the naked eye around Venus. In fact, what you'd see would be just a featureless white disk. Those clouds are the reason that Venus is so brilliant and beautiful, and therefore the reason it was named Venus, plus, of course, the fact that Venus is so close to the Earth. The clouds are very different from clouds on the Earth, however, and it's only been fairly recently that we learned this. For 3 centuries, one of the big mysteries of planetary astronomy was, what are the clouds of Venus made of? I say 3 centuries because it was obvious as soon as we had telescopes that the reason that Venus was so bright and beautiful is it was totally covered by clouds. The obvious assumption, of course, is they'd be the same kind of clouds that we have on Earth, that is, made of little droplets of frozen water. And then we discovered that they're actually quite cold. Despite the fact that it's so hot at the surface of Venus, those clouds are very definitely not at the surface. In fact, I'll jump ahead and tell you some of the Russian findings. As they went down through the clouds, they made measurements to find out where the clouds were. They turn out to be a layer of rather thin haze, actually, not the well-defined clouds that you're used to thinking of when you hear the word cloud on Earth. A layer of rather thin haze, which extends from 30 miles to 39 miles above the surface. So it's 9 miles thick, and its bottom is 30 miles up. You have a very, very high ceiling on Venus. That is 6 times as high as the highest clouds that we have on the Earth. So, even though it's so hot down there at the surface, up in the upper atmosphere, which is really where the clouds are, it's a good deal cooler. The temperature at the cloud tops, in fact, is about 150 below zero Fahrenheit, even though it's 900 degrees above down at the surface. And so, a reasonable assumption, a second guess as to what the clouds were, say 20 years ago, back when nobody knew, was that they were made of the same materials as our highest clouds, where it's very cold in our upper atmosphere, and where it's so cold that the water has frozen. And so our highest clouds, the kind we call cirrus clouds, are not made of droplets of liquid water, they're made of little crystals of ice, frozen water. So some people suggested maybe these are frozen water, maybe they're ice clouds. Another possibility, back before we knew much about Venus, was that the clouds were made of dust. Perhaps the surface temperature was hot. They didn't know then how very hot it was. Perhaps the surface temperature was hot. The planet was a global desert, and there were tremendous winds all over that desert, lifting dust into the atmosphere and keeping it up there all the time. So you had a permanent worldwide dust storm. That's by no means ridiculous. We have seen exactly that, a global dust storm on Mars. It is not permanent. Happens only at a particular time every Martian year, namely the time when Mars is closest to the Sun and the extra heat triggers the winds that raise the dust. But after all, Venus is a lot closer to the Sun than Mars or even Earth, so a global dust storm might not have been ridiculous. Well, back when we didn't know anything about it. Well, in fact, none of these turned out to be the case. And it was only 3 years ago that we found out what the clouds of Venus are made of, and nobody in a million years ever would have guessed it. The clouds of Venus turn out to be made of little drops of liquid, like those on the Earth, but the liquid is not water, it is concentrated sulfuric acid. So you've got to imagine yourself standing there on the surface of Venus, with your spacecraft slowly melting around you, and the air trying to crush you like an eggshell, and all of a sudden it begins to rain sulfuric acid. This is the planet, the Romans' name for the goddess of love and beauty. Actually, I'm being a little unfair. I always use that line because I love it. But it could not rain sulfuric acid. The surface temperature is so hot on Venus that the sulfuric acid would not only boil, it would dissociate. It would break up into simpler chemical constituents 15 miles above the surface. And so what you would have would not be at the surface would not be sulfuric acid. It would be fumes of portions of sulfuric acid, things like sulfur dioxide, sulfur trioxide, things like that. Nevertheless, it's very ironic that Venus is named Venus because it is so beautiful. The reason it's so beautiful is those hideous clouds, and I trust it is obvious that one place we are not worrying very much about searching for life is Venus, either on the surface or in the atmosphere. The poster, well, I made it from a poster. The slide that you're looking at there is about the next U.S. planetary mission, Pioneer Venus, which is going to happen this year, and as you see, consists of 2 separate spacecraft. They will be launched separately. It's a rather unusual mission in that respect. Always before, say, on Viking, when we had 2 separate spacecraft, you know, in each Viking there was a lander and there was an orbiter, but they were launched together on the same rocket. They separated when they got to the planet. In this case, there are 2 separate spacecraft. And the reason for that is not that there's any particular engineering reason for it, but because historically these were originally 2 separate projects. And so they were designed separately. And by the time it became obvious they were going to be flown together, they were already designed as separate vehicles, and so you've got to have 2 separate rockets for them. One of them is an orbiter. That's the one down in the corner there in the picture. Actually, these 2 pictures are at different scales. Both of them, as you see, are based on a drum-shaped bus, to use the term that is used in space technology for this sort of thing, which is the same size in both of them. It's 9 feet across. In fact, it is based on, of all things, the IntelSat-4 communication satellite, which was built by the same company, used aircraft. There are 2 spacecraft, then. The orbiter is this one down here. It will be launched this coming May or maybe early June. and it'll take the long way around. It'll go more than 180 degrees around the sun and arrive at Venus and go into orbit around it, if all goes well, at the very beginning of December of this year. The other spacecraft is called the Multiprobe, and I'll tell you why in a moment. It will be launched separately in July of this year, and it'll take a much shorter route. It will arrive only 5 days after the orbiter, even though it was launched several months after the orbiter, and around about December 5th of this year, the Multiprobe will arrive at Venus. 20 days out, roughly, it does it in stages, the Multiprobe will separate into pieces. There is the bus, the large drum-shaped part, and that will burn up in the upper atmosphere of Venus. It's not designed to get very far into the air. And then there are the four probes, three small ones arranged in an equilateral triangle, and the one large one. And these are called, with typical NASA ingenuity, the large probes and the small probes. Those will enter the atmosphere of Venus at four different places on the planet, which have been chosen with great care. They will go down through the atmosphere and make very extensive observations on the way down of what the atmosphere is made of, especially the minor constituents, the things other than the carbon dioxide, the clouds, how much sunlight is getting through at each level, the temperature, the pressure, all this sort of thing. Those will go down through the atmosphere. They will hit the surface, but they are not designed to survive the landing. And as a result of this strange behavior, I suspect Pioneer Venus is going to be the most underreported planetary mission in history. And that was why I wanted to come and tell you some about it today, and why I was particularly anxious. In fact, I had a discussion with the people at WKAR who were taping this, and I said, listen, if there's one remaining lecture that you're going to tape and broadcast in its entirety or in parts, this is the one, not because it's necessarily more important than the others, but because it's the one lecture, more than anything else I'm going to give you in this entire series, that there is no way anybody is going to hear about these things elsewhere. I suspect that what's going to happen is the reporters are going to get as far as the following and then lose interest in Pioneer Venus. Number one, they will find that it is not designed to survive the landing. Number two, they will realize that the Russians already have landed on Venus and have sent back pictures from the surface. And number three, they will realize that we have already landed on Mars and sent back pictures from the surface. And so they're going to say, well, what's the point? Who cares? I myself said the same sort of thing. I, for years and years, used to cite Pioneer Venus in my mind as an example of a planetary mission that really wasn't terribly important, and, you know, people would always accuse me of simply being in favor of everything that NASA did, and, you know, I cited that as an example of something I felt we could do without. But after a while, I shut up about that, because I began to realize that over and over in the past, when I hadn't seen the value of something, it was simply because I didn't know enough, and I began to have some faith in the people who make the decisions about NASA planetary programs, began to suspect that if I didn't see the value of it, it was just because I was missing something, not because they were dumb. And in fact, it was, and finally, in preparing this lecture, I found out really what Pioneer Venus is about. The reason that it's going to be a little bit hard to appreciate the value of it is that it is really a brand new kind of planetary mission, something that we have never done before. This is the first mission whose primary purpose is to study the atmosphere of another planet rather than the surface and interior. And obviously when you land on the surface and you survive and you take pictures and you look around and you do seismological studies and so forth, all the sorts of things that the Viking landers did, what you're doing is primarily a surface and interior oriented mission. Now there's nothing wrong with that. Those are important too. But Venus has a very, very important, very interesting atmosphere. And this is the first mission which is almost entirely, 87% to give you the exact number, devoted to the study of the atmosphere of a planet. We had sort of that on Viking, and by comparing what Viking is doing with which Pioneer Venus, which is a smaller and much less expensive mission, is doing, and nevertheless which is much greater as far as the atmosphere goes, you can see what the point of Pioneer Venus is. On Viking, you had a set of instruments called, collectively, entry science, which were mounted on the outside, for the most part, of the shell that protected the lander as it came in through the air on the way down. and they made a whole bunch of measurements, and we learned quite a lot of very important and interesting things about the atmosphere of Mars, and someday perhaps I can come back and tell you about those, because there are some kind of neat things there. We've learned some things about planetary atmospheres in general by generalizing those. We say, okay, here's a special circumstance of Mars, now what does this tell us about other planets? You know, why is it different from Earth, and what does that tell us about Earth? Well, Pioneer Venus, at least the MONEY probe, is all entry science. There isn't anything else. And obviously, if you've got an entire mission devoted to that, you can do a great deal more than you could in that particular area than you could in something like Viking, in which you had a few instruments that did as much of it as you happen to have room for. So you're studying the atmosphere here. Now, I suspect that the way people's biases and prejudices go, geology is more interesting from the beginning when you don't know very much about it than meteorology is. But, you know, for one thing, you get pretty pictures of geology, whereas air is air. You know, there are no cameras on those probes. What's the point of it? But there is a camera on the orbiter, and it will take pictures like this one. We'll be able to study the cloud patterns and so forth, but nothing on the probes. And so even if you got down to the surface, even if some of those probes did survive for a little while on the surface, and there is actually an excellent chance that they will, because that atmosphere is so thick that even though the probes don't have parachutes, the little ones don't have any parachutes at all. The big one has one, but it has to jettison it 15 miles up, or else it would just never reach the surface while it was still operating. The atmosphere is so thick. Imagine coming down through the oceans of the Earth with a parachute, and you'll understand what I mean. You'd simply be in them forever, right? And it'd take a long time before you finally reach the ground. So even though they won't have parachutes, by the time they reach the surface, they'll only land going at about 15 miles an hour. And there is simply slowed down by that thick atmosphere. And so there is an excellent chance that one or more of them will survive and make it to the surface. But even if they do, we aren't going to get any pictures of the surface because there's no camera on those things. This is the study of the air. It would be valuable to get to the surface. It'd be nice if one of them did, especially if the large probe, which is the one that has all the gadgetry to measure what the air is made of, did. Because by measuring the atmospheric composition right at the surface, you would get some hints as to the chemical back and forth reactions between the atmosphere and the surface at a temperature of 900 degrees, and at that pressure, you know, both temperature and pressure enhance chemical reactions. There probably is some interesting chemistry going on there. It would be nice to find out what it is. For that and for some other reasons that are more technical, it would be nice to get down to the surface. But we aren't going to have pictures from that. Okay, we want to study the atmosphere of Venus. Why? Answer, because it is the simplest atmosphere of any planet that has any air at all. For a bunch of reasons. We've always wanted to understand the weather on the Earth. And I think on a day like today, where we've got all this snow coming down, we may all die on the way home, you can understand why it is valuable from a practical point of view to understand the atmosphere of a planet, to understand meteorological processes in it. Well, one of the most valuable tools in any science is comparative studies. You want to understand one particular phenomenon, you go study a whole bunch of them, which are similar in some respects, different in others. You'll learn much more that way than if you had just one to study. And one of the big problems has always been, in understanding Earth meteorology, we've only had one atmosphere, one weather system to study. And now, finally, we can get out and study some other atmospheres, and of those, Venus is the most important just because it is the simplest. The analogy in the case of geology was the moon. It always amused me that people complained that the moon was so simple. They usually put it in different terms than that. They said it's uninteresting, it's boring. Well, that just shows they knew nothing about the moon. You know, I can talk endlessly about the moon. I find it very fascinating, and perhaps I could make you feel so also. There are a lot of interesting things about the moon. But it is much, much simpler geologically than the Earth. And that's its value. It is so simple that we can actually begin to understand it. We've already got to the point where we can predict moonquakes with about 80% accuracy. And if we can learn how to do that for the Earth, why, it's going to be very valuable. I'm sure you can see that. You want to start out with the simplest example of the phenomenon, the class of phenomena that you're studying that you can find, and that's starting out in kindergarten, and that's the moon for geology, and it's Venus for meteorology. And then you go on to more advanced stages. For meteorology, that might be, say, Mars or even Jupiter. And then finally, when you're ready for the PhD level, you go on to the complicated one, which was the Earth. Instead, we started out with the Earth. It is definitely the wrong planet to have started with in the human race's study of meteorology. We should have started out with something simpler like Venus. Well, we didn't. We weren't able to. And so we have problems. For example, we have always known that the oceans had something to do with determining the Earth's weather. We never really understood what that something was. How is it exactly that having oceans changes the weather of this planet? Well, that's a classic kind of problem in science. You think there's a variable that's affecting your results and you're not sure how it does it. And the way you like to do it in those cases is perform a control experiment. You remove the variable and see what happens. The problem is you can't do that in the case of the oceans on the Earth. The environmentalists get upset about it. You know, they talk about the whales and so forth. And it's considered nasty. So, you know, we're not allowed to do this. But you go to Venus, and if there's one thing I guarantee you, with a 900 degree Fahrenheit surface temperature, there are no oceans on Venus. There is no variation as far as amount of water is concerned, humidity, whatever you want to call it, from one place to another on Venus. Furthermore, there's no variation in temperature from one place to another. And there is almost no variation as far as the seasons go. There are two things that can cause seasons on a planet: a tilt of the planet's axis, which is what causes the seasons on the Earth, or major variations in its distance from the Sun, which is what causes the seasons on Mercury, or of course both, such as you have on Mars, and you get very complex seasons. Venus has neither, so you have no seasonal variation. Every day is the same as every other on Venus. It's a really nice, simple situation. You have an atmosphere which is made almost exclusively of just one gas, and furthermore, that gas is itself what causes the greenhouse effect. I forgot to mention that some gases are much better at greenhouse than others, and on the Earth, it so happens that the things which cause our greenhouse effect are not primarily the major gases in our atmosphere, the nitrogen and the oxygen. No, they're trace constituents, carbon dioxide and water vapor. And water vapor particularly varies in its amount quite a lot from one place to another on the Earth. Therefore, you have big variations in the amount of greenhouse effect, because water vapor is a minor trace constituent even in the most humid places on the Earth, and so small variations in it, with it causing the greenhouse, with a little of it there is causing the greenhouse, along with the carbon dioxide, which doesn't vary, but it's still a minor trace constituent, leads to all sorts of very complex changes. On Venus, you don't have that. Venus's atmosphere is almost entirely carbon dioxide. That is what's causing its greenhouse. That is why it's so very, very hot on Venus. Not just the fact that it's got 100 times as much air as we do, but that it's almost all carbon dioxide. So you're going to have a ferocious greenhouse. And on the Earth, it's much more complicated than that. I'll illustrate to you that it is complicated. Earth's atmosphere is simply not enough to produce very much. So it doesn't hold in the heat that it accumulated during the day. The heat is radiated very efficiently into space from a desert area. That is the reason why the rock group Three Dog Night is named what it is, the direct consequence of the facts that I just told you. Perhaps I better explain that. The Australian Aborigines who live in the deserts in the northern part of Australia are very familiar with the physics that I just gave you. They may not know the physics, but they're very familiar with the consequences of it from practical experience. And so they are aware that even though it's quite hot in their deserts in the daytime, at night it can get bitterly cold, freezing or below. And these, you've got to remember, are very primitive people. They have not invented the Coleman heater yet. And so in order to keep warm, they sleep with dogs at night, okay? And, you know, man's best friend and all that, woman's too for that matter. And they also, being primitive people, have not invented the Fahrenheit, let alone the Celsius, temperature scale. So they specify how cold it is on a given night by the number of dogs per person that it takes to keep warm, all right? And the coldest nights are three dog nights, and now you know, okay? You never expected to learn that by coming to a lecture on Venus, did you? Well, I'd be willing to bet the musicians themselves don't know the physics behind their name, but that's where it comes from. And on Venus, you never would have had such a circumstance because the greenhouse effect is absolutely uniform from one place to another just because there is so little variation in the air. So what I'm trying to show you is that Venus is the kindergarten place to go to learn about meteorology. And even though there are only four probes on that multi-probe spacecraft, together with the bus, which will make some studies of the upper atmosphere before it burns up at a height of about 80 miles, that should be enough to characterize the entire meteorology of the entire planet. So we expect a major increase in our understanding of how weather works as a result of the Pioneer Venus mission, which is coming up at the end of this year as far as the data gathering goes, and of course the results of it will be coming out during the several years after that. I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail about the Pioneer Venus mission itself in this lecture, because I've given this lecture before and I found there just isn't time for it. That's really another whole lecture, and perhaps sometime I can come back and give that. What I'm going to talk about today, however, primarily, is what we already know about Venus. In other words, give you the background that you would want to know if you wanted to understand the Pioneer Venus mission. But that I told you, at least, is a broad outline of it. And the main thing to remember is that there are those two spacecraft, and of them, the multiprobe is a brand new kind of mission, an atmospheric probe, rather than something to land or something to crash or something that we're also doing on Pioneer Venus and have done before, and that is something to orbit the planet and study it from the outside. Probes may be new now, but we are going to be seeing them increasingly in the years to come. The outer planets, the giant planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, which I'm going to talk about in the next two lectures in much more detail, are planets on which you cannot land. There is nothing to land on. They are nothing but gigantic balls of atmosphere. They are gas, or if you want to call something really really thick that is fluid, call it a liquid. They're gaseous and liquid throughout. And so the kind of studies of those planets that you would do are very, very different from the sort of things you would do on, say, Mars or the Moon, where you would land and study the surface. Those would be probes. And one way to look at Pioneer Venus is that it's a sort of rehearsal on our next door planet for the probe missions, which NASA is hoping to send into the atmospheres of at least Jupiter and Saturn, and maybe someday Uranus and Neptune as well, starting in the 1980s. These are pictures of Venus taken from the Earth, and of course, everybody's first reaction to these is that it looks just like the Moon, but it does not. You can see there are no craters, there are no mare, there are no anything visible. The entire planet is simply covered by this featureless white deck of clouds. And that, as I've mentioned, is the reason that Venus is called Venus. It is the whitest object in the solar system. It reflects 80% of the light that hits it. In other words, only 20% gets down below those clouds. It's pretty incredible that Venus is twice as hot as Mercury, even though it, A, gets half as much sunlight, and B, 80% of what it does get gets reflected back into space, whereas Mercury not only gets twice as much sunlight as Venus does, but absorbs practically all of it. You see how very, very important the greenhouse effect can be. These pictures, taken from the Earth, show the various phases that Venus is in. This is the one that it's in right now, when it's essentially directly behind the Sun. And this is the one that it gets when it is almost directly between the Earth and the Sun. And you can see something else there that you will never see on the Moon, and that is, in addition to the crescent, you have a thin continuation of the crescent all the way around. What you're seeing there is simply the atmosphere itself lighted up from behind. So very early in our studies of Venus, it became obvious the planet did in fact have an atmosphere. This is the way Venus looks, absolutely white, blank, featureless, even close up, even as close as Mariner 10 got at its closest, which was this far away at this scale, 3,300 miles. If you take pictures in any wavelength that is visible to the eye, for some reason, if you go to the ultraviolet, which is not visible to the eye, but is just below the wavelengths, the shortest wavelengths we can see, which are the blue and violet. If you go to the ultraviolet, for some reason, you get all those markings, which you saw in the last picture, an ultraviolet picture. They are not nearly as intense. If you had eyes that could see ultraviolet, they wouldn't be nearly as intense as you saw in that picture. Remember, the contrast was really jacked up in that picture, but nevertheless, they exist, and nobody really knows why they do that and why they seem to be visible only in the ultraviolet. But from close up, Venus is simply this featureless white planet. Venus is, as I mentioned, visible in broad daylight. Here is a picture which I took in Ann Arbor. If any of you have been to the U of M campus, I'm sure you recognize one of our best-known landmarks. This is the Burton Memorial Tower, the Bell Tower, everybody calls it, because it's got the Carillon in it. And you can see from this picture that I took it at 11:15 in the morning, and so it was obviously the middle of the day, and there, visible in broad daylight, is the planet Venus. Can you see it? People in the back perhaps are having some trouble, but the people up front, I imagine, are able to see that little white dot. And that is, in fact, very much the way that Venus looks when you see it in the naked eye in daytime. It's exactly the same chalky white color as the Moon is in daytime. I assume most of you have seen the Moon in daytime. Some people haven't. Some people are surprised when you tell them it's visible sometimes in the day. But, you know, anything that is bright enough to shine through the blue scattered sunlight that is our blue sky is visible in the daytime. You'd be able to see stars in the daytime if they were brighter or if the skylight were fainter. They're still up there. They don't go to bed. They're just not visible because the blue skylight drowns them out. And so Venus is barely visible in broad daylight because it is the brightest thing in the sky except for the sun and the moon. It appears that chalky white, and it is quite obvious to the naked eye, at least on a day when there's no haze, when you see it. So if you're ever looking for it, and you think you see it but you're not sure, then you're not seeing it. At least if you have any sort of normal eyesight and if it is not a hazy day. The trick about seeing Venus in the daytime is that it's easy when you are looking directly at it. But if you look just a little bit to one side, you lose it. And it's very hard to find it again. And so, of course, it has an elusive quality. You know, oh, gee, I thought I saw something up there, but now I can't find it again. You know, am I cracking up or what? And all through history, there have been cases of people happening accidentally to glance in the right direction and noticing it and going ape, you know, because they couldn't understand what this thing was that they were seeing up there. And, of course, they always interpret it in terms of the mythology of their own particular time and culture. And so at various times, it's been a god or a devil or a demon or an angel or, in our time, of course, a flying saucer. Venus is also very often reported as a UFO at night. In fact, Venus is the commonest UFO. Whenever I'm asked, do you believe Venus very, very bright in the western sky after sunset, and listening to the phone calls come in one after another all night long, and you appreciate how many UFOs there are. I think of one particular night when I got to the point where, you know, every 5 minutes the phone was ringing. I just got to the point where I would answer it. Observatory, the bright thing in the western sky is Venus. And usually they just say thanks and hang up. It really saves time. Venus is the commonest reported UFO, as shown by the exhaustive analysis of tens of thousands of studies reported sightings that have been done. The UFO, which was so widely publicized that President Carter reported back when he was governor of Georgia, was Venus, and you know, many others as well. And well, you know, that's fine. I'm not making fun of President Carter. I'm very happy that he's so interested in Venus. I hope he'll generalize it to other planets. But it was in fact Venus. And it's amazing how different from what you expect a really, really bright point source of light such as Venus can look. And that's why people will say, oh, come on, it can't possibly have been a planet. I know what a planet looks like. You're trying to make fun of me. It may seem to show colors. Those are caused by the Earth's atmosphere. They're quite real, but they're not part of Venus. It may seem to have a shape that's caused by the eye. The shape may seem to change since it isn't real. It may seem to move around. It may seem to throw off sparks. That's due to the Earth's atmosphere again. And, of course, if you're driving in your car, it follows you. And, you know, when you know what the answer is, that seems funny. But when you don't, it can really be frightening. And it's amazing how many UFO reports of strange, bright objects following cars turn out to be Venus, usually, or some other bright star or planet. And, you know, you're driving along and you don't pay much attention to it, and then all of a sudden you turn right, and promptly it turns right, you know, and you're getting a little bit worried because there you are out there in the country and you're a little paranoid anyway, and you're driving along and a little bit later on you turn left and it turns left. And finally you get up your nerve and you stop your car and it stops. And this kind of thing really can't happen. I don't know if that was the details of what happened in the case of the Carter sighting. I don't know all the details of what he reported. But in any case, Venus, with seen often under that sort of circumstances, is the commonest UFO. Okay, let me tell you a little bit about the clouds of Venus. Study of them is interesting for a number of reasons, one of which is, believe it or not, you know, people are always so amazed when they hear that you got a planet here covered with a planet-wide cloud deck made of concentrated sulfuric acid. But believe it or not, we have such things on the Earth at least two different levels. One of them is a layer of sulfuric acid droplets, a very thin layer, not as dense as the Venus clouds, and certainly not as thick and mild. But nevertheless, it is there in our stratosphere at the level where the temperature and the pressure are about the same as that where the clouds of Venus are. Of course, that's much higher up above the surface on the Earth, on Venus rather, than it is on the Earth, since the air is so much denser at the surface. This is called the Junge layer, after the guy who discovered it, and it is not really very well understood. We know that the sulfuric acid is of natural origin. It was there long before there was any man-made atmospheric pollution, but exactly where it comes from, we don't understand. So there's a constituent of the Earth's atmosphere, which perhaps we can get some hints on by studying the clouds of Venus. where the chemistry is obviously quite different to the surface, and yet you have a rather similar layer in an analogous layer of the atmosphere. But in addition, you have things like this. This is a Skylab photograph of a portion of our own planet, the Midwest, in fact, somewhere in the Midwest, I have no idea where, there's no way you can tell in that picture. You can see there are a lot of contrails that day, and a lot of cumulus clouds as well. But in addition, there is a tremendous amount of air pollution visible in this photograph. All that haze is air pollution. Very often, the haze that constitutes one of our most important forms of air pollution, one of the complex of phenomena that we just lump together and call smog, unless you happen to be a specialist in the subject, one of the versions of smog is a layer at the surface, and here man-made generated, not natural, of apparently small droplets of sulfuric acid. And there you are breathing the stuff, and it is eroding into natural and man-made objects. Cleopatra's needle, which stood in the Egyptian desert for thousands of years without any damage, has now gotten to the point from simply standing for a century in Central Park in New York City where you can hardly read the inscriptions anymore. And it's simply a result of, among other things, attacked by this man-made sulfuric acid. Well, we know, or we think we know, that it is sulfuric acid. It appears to be made of droplets that are about the same size and in many cases about the same concentration as those in the clouds of Venus, but there is a lot that is not understood about how the gunk is generated and, equally important, about how it has gotten out of the atmosphere. And so there is something about, of all things, air pollution that we expect to learn some things about by going to Venus and sending down those Pioneer Venus multiprobes through the atmosphere. There would apparently be a great deal more sulfuric acid in the Earth's atmosphere, so much so that it would be very Venus-like and might actually make it impossible for life to live here if it were not for the fact that it's enough colder here on Earth that we have this strange phenomenon of liquid water, which, among other things, falls out of the sky as rain and washes the atmosphere clean. If it never rained on the Earth, sulfuric acid might actually become a constituent of the atmosphere up to perhaps the percent level. So you can be very happy that it rains on this planet or even snows, despite the inconvenience that it can cause on days like today. This is a picture of one of the spacecraft that we learned a great deal about what we know about Venus from, one of several. I should say that we have learned essentially all of what we know about that planet, aside from its size and its position in the solar system, its orbit, that kind of thing. Essentially all of what we know about its physical nature in the last 10 years or so. And the sources were the spacecraft Mariner 2, 5, and 10, especially 10, which took the pictures, and then the Russian Venera series, starting with Venera 4 and running up through the most recent of the landers that took the pictures, Venera 10. But in addition to the spacecraft, something else that is not nearly as highly publicized and in many ways just as remarkable, and that is radar astronomy. We have got to the point where we can make maps of the surface of Venus from Earth 25 million miles away through the clouds that are so detailed that you can see things as small as half a mile across by bouncing radar off the planet. And I will show you some of those radar maps a little bit later on. It was from the radar that we learned, for example, that Venus has the slowest rotation of any planet in the solar system, has the longest day. In fact, Venus is the only planet that we know whose day is longer than its year. Venus rotates on its axis once in 243 Earth days. It revolves completely around the Sun, in other words, the length of its year, in 225. And it rotates in the wrong direction, so that if you were on Venus, the Sun would seem to rise in the west. It would travel very, very, very slowly across the sky, and its apparent motion across the sky would be more due to the orbital motion of Venus around the Sun than it would be to the rotation of the planet, so that the time that it's set would not even approximately half of a real Venus day, a Venus rotation period later. It would, in fact, be 56 Earth days later, and then you would have continuous night for 56 Earth days, aside from certain atmospheric effects that I haven't talked about. And it would rise in the west, and it would set 56 Earth days later in the east. I'll tell you much later on, at the very end of the lecture, why it is that Venus rotates in that way. It's been one of the mysteries of planetary astronomy ever since it was discovered by radar studies of Venus around about 12 years ago now, and we finally, about a year ago, got an explanation of it, which seems to hold up. It's really quite a remarkable explanation, but I want to leave it till the end because I need the overhead projector here for it, and I want to run through the slides first. In any case, I want to take up the spacecraft history of Venus with Mariner 10, the one that gave us the first pictures. This is a painting by Cesare Bonestell of what Mariner 10 might have looked like as it approached Venus. Venus was the Mariner 10, rather, was the first spacecraft that ever went to two planets, one after the other, using the technique which has now gotten to be fairly familiar because it's been used quite a bit in outer solar system missions, called gravity assist, where you fly past one planet in just the right direction and at just the right distance that that planet's gravity will change your speed and deflect your direction of motion by exactly the right amount to send you on to the next planet. Of course, you can only do that on certain very, very special occasions when the next planet will be there when you arrive. And in fact, when Mariner 10 was launched in 1973, November 3rd, 1973, the planets Venus and Mercury were approaching such a configuration. I say approaching because, after all, you want them to reach that configuration when you get to them, not the day you launch them. And they're not going to do that again until 1983. So Mariner 10 was primarily remembered, I suppose, by the public as the first spacecraft to go to Mercury. And that was, in fact, believe it or not, one of the paradoxes of orbital mechanics in the solar system is that it is actually easier and it takes less fuel to go to Pluto than it does to go to Mercury, simply because you are dealing with such strong gravitational fields of the Sun when you get in that close to the Sun. With present-day rockets, there is no way we could have gone directly to Mercury, unless you wanted to use up a Saturn V for this mission, and there's no way you could get that kind of money out of the politicians. So really, this was the only way that we could have gone. Well, Mariner 10 had a camera on board because we wanted pictures of Mercury. Nobody had ever bothered to put cameras on any of the earlier Venus spacecraft simply because everybody knew that it was totally covered by clouds, and so there was nothing to take a picture of. Finally, we put a camera on Mariner 10, and in fact, turned out there were things to take pictures of in the ultraviolet. And you've already seen one of those pictures. In a moment, I'll discuss it in greater detail. Since Venus was closer to us than Mercury, we actually, ironically, ended up with more pictures of Venus than we did of Mercury, 5,000 as opposed to 3,000. But since you were going on to Mercury, you had to approach the planet not from what might have been the scientifically most optimum direction, but from the direction such that you would get the gravity assist and you would go on to Mercury. That happened to be the direction from immediately behind as seen from the Sun. In other words, Mariner 10 approached Venus from the night side. It couldn't see anything until it made its closest approach, and then suddenly the planet became visible, and Mariner 10 swung around and took pictures of it for 2 weeks afterwards on the way out. This is a painting by Bonestell of the moment when finally a little bit of the day side of Venus first appeared to Mariner 10, so it would have seen it as a very thin crescent like this, and then as it swung around rapidly, the phase would have changed until it appeared as a full Venus, and then, of course, moved around on the other side again. The next picture that I'm going to show you is of only historic interest. There's nothing very much to see in it, but it is the very first picture which Mariner 10 took as soon as it was able to see the lighted crescent. And the way it was programmed to do those very first pictures was to start out at this tip of the crescent and then rapidly go down the crescent and take one frame after another until it got to the other tip. So here comes the first picture ever taken by a spacecraft of Venus, and that's it. February 1974, and this is the very tip of the crescent of Venus, which would have gone around like so. And the reason that it peters out over there is defect of either the camera or the, more likely than many generations of copying as this picture has gone through before I was able to make this slide, rather than something on Venus. And that is not real either. That's on the Viticon faceplate of the camera. Well, the main thing that you notice is that there isn't a whole lot visible. There is no obvious detail, and this was the first place where we began to get the suspicion that in visible light, all you see is blank white. So most of the pictures that were taken by Mariner 10 were in visible light and therefore showed nothing whatever except blank white, and so I'm not going to bother to show you any. Here, however, is a set of mosaics of Mariner 10 Venus pictures. Mosaics, by which I mean, well, you can just barely see the join lines in this big one here, and this picture was taken 2 days out, and then here you have a series of them taken at seven-hour intervals. The color in this picture is completely fake. It was a black and white picture, and it was taken in ultraviolet. The reason I added the color was, A, to make it look a little prettier, I suppose, and B, to illustrate to you that it was taken only in one color band. That is to say, not blue, but the color that is next beyond blue, and they couldn't show you that, so they showed you blue. You know, I suppose it's justifiable in some respects. But you should understand, A, that it's a black and white picture, B, that it's ultraviolet, and C, that again, in all of these pictures, the contrast has been very, 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 very enhanced. Well, the first thing you notice is that there are black regions and there are white regions, that is, darker regions and lighter regions, actually, and the difference in their reflectivities is actually quite small. The black ones are considerably less than, are considerably more than half as reflective as the white ones. Again, contrast has been enhanced here. But nobody really knows what it is that you're seeing. There are several possibilities. I'm sure your first reaction, if you know the planets, when you look at a picture like this, is that it looks like Jupiter. That is, there are stripes in the clouds. We know that when we look at Jupiter, what we are seeing as the dark stripes is actually holes in between portions, not an entire planet-wide cloud deck, but portions of a cloud deck, where we are looking in between the flats, so to speak, down to a lower layer, which for some reason is darker. In the case of Jupiter, presumably because it's either made of a different material or at least covered by a different material. It is possible that that's what we're seeing here. Now, I know there are some people in the audience who have heard me give earlier lectures on Venus. I went on for years saying that definitely that was what it was. But it turns out that was just the first interpretation. We have now advanced to the point where we don't know what it is that we're seeing in this picture. And that is sometimes the way science proceeds. You know, first you come up with a hypothesis, and then you have to realize that you don't know what you're seeing before you can go on and find out what it really is, which hopefully is the third stage. It may be that these are simply places in the clouds where there is some unknown coloring substance which colors only in ultraviolet. In white light, remember, or in any visible color, it all looks the same. Or it may even be that these are higher clouds, darker ones, which we're seeing above the lower and brighter ones instead of the other way around. We simply do not know. In any case, whatever it is that we're seeing, it's obvious that these dark things, whatever they are nicely delineating the wind circulation in the cloud layer. And please remember that that is not anything related to the wind circulation down on the surface, 40 miles below. This is the wind circulation up at the top of the cloud level, and it is in fact very, very, very different. At the surface, first of all, the surface, and therefore the atmosphere, rotates only once every 243 days. Here, at the top of the clouds, 40 miles up, the cloud features move around the planet so rapidly, and you can see that in these bottom three pictures. This one was taken at a certain time, 2 days out from the planet. This was taken 7 hours later. This was taken 14 hours later. There is a feature which has been indicated by these arrows here in the clouds, one of the dark features, about the size of the United States, which has moved more than its own diameter, more than 3,000 miles in just 14 hours. And in fact, it goes completely around the planet in a period of 4 Earth days. Not 243, 4. This wind system at the top of the clouds is therefore referred to as the four-day circulation. It also is in what we're used to thinking of as the wrong direction. It moves around in the opposite direction to most planetary rotations in the solar system. And considering that it's moving at that speed and the surface is moving at once every 243 days, what that means is that there are winds in those upper cloud layers of 250 miles an hour. One of the great mysteries in planetary science now is what is causing those winds. On a planet where, at least further down, there is essentially zero temperature variation, therefore zero pressure variation, anywhere from one point to another in the atmosphere, and that is what is supposed to cause winds. So right away you begin to see that even though this is the simplest meteorology in the solar system, there are things about it that we do not understand, and that is very, very important. Because if we don't understand something this simple, that is giving us a clue that we don't understand much more complex systems, such as the weather system that we have here on the Earth. One thing we do understand, though, we've understood it ever since there was a science of meteorology, and that is what causes these strikes. As I said, if you know Jupiter, you may have looked at this picture and thought, gee, that looks exactly like Jupiter, but in fact, it does not, in a very important respect. Those strikes, the bright ones and dark ones, are not parallel to the equator. They don't run along lines of latitude. Instead, they start out on either side of the equator and spiral continuously around the planet, like so. There is one such spiral here in the southern hemisphere, and there is another such spiral up in the northern hemisphere. That is very familiar to anybody who has studied meteorology. It always appears in about chapter 2 of every elementary meteorology textbook. It was invented at the very beginning of the science of meteorology by James Hadley, who was an astronomer by profession. As a matter of fact, he was an astronomer royal, and some of you may remember Apollo 15, which landed at a place on the moon called Hadley Rill, and that was named by named for James Hadley. But in addition, in his spare time, Hadley founded the science of meteorology. He's known as the father of meteorology. And Hadley said, here is the way the circulation of air on a planet ought to go. It's hottest at the equator, right? And it's coldest at the poles. Hot air rises, cold air sinks. So what you ought to have is a situation where hot air rises up above the equator and cold air sinks down at the poles. Well, that hot air that is rising at the equator has to go someplace, and the cold air that is sinking at the poles has to come from someplace, and those two places are the same. What will happen, since there's something pushing at the pole and pulling at the pole and pushing at the equator, is the hot air that rises at the equator is going to move due north and due south along meridians of longitude. The hot air is going to rise up at the equator, move up to the poles, and there sink back down. And then to complete the cycle, return to the equator along the surface. So what you ought to have is a nice simple loop, if you want to think of it that way, a loop in cross section. Remember, it's happening all the way around the planet at once. A nice simple loop of air rising to the equator, flowing up at altitude to the poles, sinking down to the poles, and then returning to the equator along the surface. Except that the planet is rotating, and the planet's rotation will twist that nice simple north and south flow into a spiral. So instead of the air flowing along meridians of longitude, it is going to flow along a spiral, one twist in the northern hemisphere, or one spiral in the northern hemisphere, and one in the southern. Well, that was a nice theory. The problem is, it doesn't happen on Earth, because we have too complex a meteorology. There are oceans someplace on Earth, and the air is picking up humidity, which has very significant effects on our weather from those places. There are not oceans other places on Earth. And furthermore, this planet rotates very rapidly. So rapidly that nice, simple, non-turbulent flow is broken up into cells. High pressure and low pressure systems, our storm centers and our fair weather places. And so we don't see that sort of Hadley circulation on Earth. And it appears in chapter 2 of every meteorology textbook, followed immediately by an explanation that you don't see it. It's a nice theory, but it's too simple because our planet is more complex than that. But there, on the planet, with the simplest meteorology in the solar system, there you see exactly what Hadley predicted almost two centuries ago. There you see a real live Hadley circulation. Hadley was absolutely right. He just had the wrong planet. And so you see that some of our nice, simple, theoretical meteorology is on the right track. And yet, even on Venus, even on this place with this simple weather system, there are things we do not understand. I told you why we have a Hadley circulation, but I didn't tell you, because nobody knows, why it stops at about latitude 60 degrees south and about latitude 60 degrees north, and suddenly the spirals melt into a ring. It's called the polar ring, although it's not really very polar at 60 degrees. There's a polar ring in each hemisphere, and it really is parallel to the equator. And below that, to the poles, there is nothing but essentially a featureless atmosphere. What causes that polar ring? What breaks up that nice, simple Hadley circulation? What's happening to the air down there? We don't know. But needless to say, one of the Pioneer Venus probes is going to go down into the atmosphere at about that latitude and try to find out. Show you something else that's more complicated than Hadley said. You notice perhaps that in between these spirals, over there on the left of the picture, there is a region where there, whatever is going on, it doesn't seem to be the nice simple Hadley circulation. That has been given the rather picturesque name of the Eye of Venus. And what it is the place as seen from which the sun would be directly overhead. In other words, that's the place where the sun is shining directly down onto the planet. That is where it is hottest at that particular place. The Hadley circulation splits in two and is forced around the eye of Venus. What is going on in that eye? We don't know. One thing that you see in the eye very clearly is this cellular structure of the clouds. The clouds seem to be made of a bunch of little blobs. Well, we're used to that on the Earth. We see it all the time. In fact, in that Skylab picture of a portion of the Earth, you saw cellular clouds, among other kinds, just like that. They're cumulus clouds. They're the little puffy, cottony-looking clouds that you see over the fields in a warm summer afternoon. And they are caused by a process that is very well understood on Earth. It's called convection. And what it means is, you have a place down on the ground that's a little bit warmer. Maybe it's an open field and the rest is forest, or maybe it's an asphalt parking lot and the rest is vegetated or whatever. Whatever it is, a little bit warmer, therefore the air is rising, just locally, not a planetary thing, a local thing, just rising up there. As it rises, it expands and cools, and eventually a cloud is formed up at the top of this rising column of warm air, because it gets to the point where it's cooled enough that it can no longer hold its moisture, and then it gets up to a certain height, that's the puffy cauliflower-like top of the cumulus cloud, and spills over at the sides and fountains back down to the bottom, where it gets heated up again. See, it's been cooled by its rise through the air, gets heated up again, repeats the cycle. Well, that's fine. Convective clouds are easy to understand, except for one thing. What's causing convection on that planet? The temperature is supposed to be so nice and uniform. It's certainly easy to understand why the temperature is so uniform. It's so extreme, and the greenhouse effect is so efficient. So what are we doing seeing cumulus clouds there in Venus? We don't know, and these are some of the things that we are hoping to find out from the Pioneer Venus probes. So one of the big things that they are intended to study is the circulation of the atmosphere of Venus, which is to say, the wind pattern. But you can see it is a much simpler circulation than Earth's, and above all, you do not have in this simple, almost pure Hadley circulation planet, you do not have any hint of the breakup of the circulation into high and low pressure areas. In other words, there is no such thing as a storm to trouble and make complex the meteorology on Venus. Here is something else which is kind of interesting, and in fact illustrates more vividly than the other picture that I showed you, the breakup of the Hadley circulation around the eye of Venus. And that is that occasionally, when the distribution of these dark features, whatever they are, is right, you can see the breakup forming a sort of letter Y over there on its side. And that is so conspicuous close up that just barely, with great difficulty, it is visible all the way from Earth if you take pictures in ultraviolet light. And here you see one that was taken at one of the very, very best observing sites on the Earth. One of the places where our atmosphere, which is one of the biggest problems in astronomy, I'll tell you, because it's never steady. It never holds still. One of the places where our atmosphere is as still as it gets, Pic du Midi Observatory in France, you can see that Y-shaped feature where, if we only knew what was going on, what was happening was the Hadley circulation was splitting up on either side of the eye of Venus. This is a picture of something else that was taken by Mariner 10, which I put in primarily so that in case you ever run into it, you won't get confused. And that is, those dots are not real, those are on the Vidicon faceplate. You put a